Counsel, the next case this morning is 23-3074, Awiha v. State of Kansas.
May it please the court. This case is about whether Title VII makes unlawful racial and national origin discrimination in employment generally, or only when that racial and national origin discrimination fits within a certain specific formula or mathematical rubric of discriminatory actions. Your Honor, the general case law and law about Title VII and hostile work environment, disparate treatment, and retaliation is well known. This case is about the facts, so that's where I'm going to spend most of my time. In general, Ms. Awiha, a Black Nigerian-born woman, worked as a staff pharmacist for Larned State Hospital from September 2017 until June 2020. For the majority of that time, she was the only Nigerian-born person in that pharmacy, and she was the only Black person in that pharmacy. During that time, she was subjected to continuous hostility and racial and national origin-based demeaning remarks and questions and conduct from her coworkers, none of which were treated the same as she was, all of which were not Nigerian-born and were not Black.
Counsel, before you go too much further, I noticed that the district court, two of the issues are under 12B6 dismissals here before us. The rest of them are summary judgments. Is that your understanding, dude?
Your Honor, I believe all we're bringing forth is the summary judgment.
Just the summary judgment. Okay, thank you.
I apologize for not making that clear.
No.
Start. But again, going back, Ms. Awiha was treated differently than her coworkers, who were, again, were not Nigerian and were not Black.
Well, when she complained about her conduct, she did not say that she did not raise race or her national origin, did she?
She said she did not remember exactly what she said.
Well, she doesn't remember. That's a pretty important thing to remember, isn't it? Whether you felt you were racially or discriminated based upon national origin.
She said she did not remember the exact words, but she said specifically, I made it clear that I was being discriminated against.
Well, you can be discriminated against for reasons that the law doesn't protect. You can be discriminated against because they don't like you, and therefore I'm not treated similarly. I'm not treated the same as my peers. That's not something that would get you relief, would it?
Your Honor, I believe discriminated against would imply, at least taking the facts most in favor of the plaintiff and drawing inferences therefrom, that discriminated against in normal parlance would imply and would infer a class-based, a protected class-based, especially when it's the only Nigerian, it's the only Black person saying this, especially when she says, one of the things I'm offended by is the fact that my coworker brought in slave trade beads to shove in front of my face and tell me that that was my heritage.
Well, we got the slave trade beads, and I mean, I think that there's a colorful argument there that implicates both race and national origin. But your position is that just saying you're discriminated against, well, I mean, she's a woman too. I mean, you could say that she felt discriminated against on the grounds of gender, and you're not raising that, are you?
No, but again, if that's what the employer believed, that she was saying she was discriminated against because of gender, and then took an adverse employment action, that would certainly qualify as a Title VII retaliation action, I believe.
But that's not the argument you're making here.
That's not the argument I'm making, but the argument I'm making is that the employer knew through her supervisor, through complaints, repeated complaints to her supervisor about being discriminated against, about being treated unfairly, about being treated differently than everyone else, and about clearly racial or national origin-based conduct, that the reasonable inference that a jury can draw is that the employer was well aware that Ms. Awiha was making complaints about activity that is made unlawful by Title VII. Now, is the jury required to draw that conclusion? Maybe not, but that I don't believe is the question for the court on the question of whether or not she was retaliated against, whether or not she engaged in protected activity. But going back to the facts of the issue is that the facts show that for the almost three years that she worked there, she never had a single informal or formal disciplinary action taken against her. She was never reprimanded by her supervisors or anyone else. In fact, the facts show that she dutifully performed her activities despite the abuse, harassment, and exclusion she faced on account of her race and national origin. However, despite that, this action continued, and in fact intensified, in the spring and summer of 2020, likely related to the general national focus on the issues of race and discrimination that were going on at that time. In fact, one of the things that came out of that was a letter by the Kansas Governor Kelly about the George Floyd death and subsequent protests, it offering support for black employees of the state like Ms. Wehaw. That letter was dated June 3rd, 2020. Ms. Wehaw put that letter up, and that incensed her coworkers.
And the district court said that you waive reliance on that letter. And you have not engaged with that district court ruling that you waive reliance on that letter. So how can you rely on that letter now?
Your Honor, I'm relying on that letter not as a specific protected activity for retaliation. I'm relying on that letter to show the hostile work environment and that the ultimate adverse employment decision was based upon Ms. Wehaw's race and national origin.
Well, I'm not sure. Why can you rely on the letter at all? I mean, you didn't include it as any piece of evidence related to the climate, the existence that goes on in that office. Why is it a non-issue at all?
Your Honor, respectfully, that letter was an exhibit to the summary judgment. It was discussed in the summary judgment motion as to explain the hostile work environment, especially the negative reaction that letter got by her coworkers. And the fact that so shortly, close there in time after that letter was posted, these events occurred.
And help me to understand then, how does that relate to the fact that it was not listed in the pretrial order and the district court said that you waived it?
Again, I believe the district court was talking about it as a specific protected activity, not as a piece of evidence to the hostile work environment or adverse employment action, because those are, all those Title VII claims are of different nature and species. So,
okay.
Again, the retaliation, Your Honor, that I bring before you is the informal complaints to the supervisor. That is the most clear, obvious instances of protected activity.
I know you're doing a recitation of the facts, but we've also got to look at the claims that have been made here. And could you address on the hostile work environment claim, are you making an argument based on severity or pervasiveness?
Your Honor, it's both. And I believe it's either or is generally how that's...
Well, that's why I'm asking you that. If it's the former, that is severity, what is the strongest evidence of severity?
The severity, Your Honor, the strongest evidence is the slave trade beads, which is an incredibly offensive action. The second strongest is the comment by Ms. Wehaw's direct supervisor, Mary Seddon, that Nigerian women are uneducated and those that are educated are bossy. And then the pervasiveness, Your Honor, is just the continuous demeaning conduct, demeaning questions. Does Nigeria even have schools? Do you even have roads? Do you even have cars? Do you even have currency? I mean, those are clearly demeaning questions. It's not a dog whistle, that's an error. That's saying Nigeria is not a civilized country. Nigerians are not civilized people. They don't have the basic amenities and features we associate with civilized people. We're surprised to learn that they might have them, and we do not believe they do.
What would you say in our case law would be most comparable to this situation on hostile work environment, at least in terms of supporting your claim?
Sure, Your Honor. Three cases come to mind. Hernandez v. Valley View Hospital Association. That was a similar case where there was subjected to racial, insensitive, and offensive comments that the plaintiff was able to give a few examples of and then describe that those were continuous.
And they actually used racial epithets, right, in Hernandez?
I believe there may have been racial epithets, but I do not believe Hernandez stood for or indicated that this was some sort of mathematical formula that you have to check this box.
Oh, I'm not saying it did that, but you responded that that's a comparable case. And the point I'm making is you don't have that here, right?
We do not have that one element, but we have a bunch of other similar elements.
Which is?
Which is the continuous demeaning comments about her schooling, about her country, about questions about her hair. We have her qualifications being constantly questioned because of where she went to school. She went to school in Nigeria because she went there instead of that. These questions were not asked of her coworkers. These questions were not directed to her coworkers.
And one could argue that those were neutral things. There was nothing facially discriminatory about those questions. Somebody from Kansas doesn't know anything about Nigeria. They ask questions.
It's possible, Your Honor.
Okay.
But I don't believe the question is whether an innocent explanation is possible. I believe that the question is, could a reasonable jury find that it was not for an innocent reason?
That's true. But I mean, when you look at the quote, I think it was Hernandez, in fact, that talked about this notion of neutral factors. But the neutral factors have to be considered in the context of factors that themselves speak to racial animus. And then they have meaning. Well, the point here is, unlike Hernandez, you don't have any facially discriminatory conduct beyond perhaps the slave beads, do you?
Well, Your Honor, I certainly state the statement that from a supervisor that Nigerian women are uneducated and those that are educated are bossy is directly and facially on point about national origin. I mean, it specifically references Nigerian women. I don't know, frankly, I don't know how you could be more on point or more facially discriminatory than that. So again, when you combine the neutral, arguably neutral, comments and actions that I was discussing previously, combine that with the statements that by her own coworkers that she didn't fit in with that crowd, that they were Trumpers and rednecks, and what is the implication there? What is the implication that they were incensed by her posting the governor's letter? And then a few days later, she's suspended and ultimately terminated for getting yelled at by a coworker, for having a coworker threaten her. That's what she was suspended and terminated for.
I thought, well, go ahead, Judge Palmer.
Which then brings up the issue of pretextual. You're arguing that the statements made were pretextual or, as we've said specifically, not worthy of belief. So on that basis, which of the comments made by her co-employees or by the superiors there are not worthy of belief? Pretextual.
Her protection? I apologize.
Say protection. I said pretextual.
Oh, pretextual. I apologize, Your Honor. Pretextual is very clear in this case. It's from the investigation, the sham investigation launched by Prescott. The statements made against their allegations are that she was on her phone all the time. Well, the phone record shows she wasn't. She was she was asleep all the time. Well, her own supervisor said she never caught her sleeping once, even though that's what the claims were, and that she was aware of maybe one instance where she might have been asleep at work in the break room.
Are you saying that Prescott had racial or national origin bias?
I'm saying either she had national or racial origin bias, or she was fully committed to not only rubber stamping, but justifying the race and national origin-based employment action that the pharmacy wanted to take against Ms. Aweha by not...
Let's not speak in terms of pharmacy. There has to be somewhere along this chain. Ms. Prescott is conducting an investigation. Ms. Dittman, I think that's her name, she's the decision maker, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you claiming that she had racial or national origin bias?
No, Your Honor, but we are claiming that she had no independent investigation or thought about the matter and simply rubber stamped the recommendation to terminate Ms. Aweha.
Well, then somewhere along this line, there has to be somebody who had racial and national origin bias. And so if Ms. Prescott, she may have been committed to getting rid of Ms. Aweha for many reasons, but if they aren't protected reasons, it doesn't matter, does it?
Well, the reason she wanted to get rid of them is because the people in the pharmacy, her co-workers, John Fox, Janet Finger, and her supervisor, Mary Seddon, had demonstrated a severe hostility to Ms. Aliha based off her race and national origin.
They told her that they had hostility against her because of her race and national origin?
I don't believe they told her, but they clearly demonstrated through her actions. And I apologize, Your Honor. I see that I'm out of time.
And let me, I interrupted your answer to Judge Matheson. You said you had three cases. Just so that the record is clear, you had Hernandez as comparable cases.
Lowndes,
Hernandez.
Oh, I apologize.
Go ahead, please.
Lowndes v. Lynn Care.
Yes.
And McCowan v. Ulster Maintenance, Inc.
Okay. All right. And we'll give you a little bit of rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate that.
May it please the Court. My name is Jeff Kuhlman, and it's my privilege to represent the defendants' appellees in this matter, who I'll just refer to as the defendants in the course of my argument. Two of this Court's well-established and often-cited maxims apply squarely to this matter. In the hostile work environment context, that maxim is that Title VII does not establish a general civility code, and a few isolated incidents do not constitute a hostile work environment. The second maxim is in the employment law context, which is that when looking at employment cases, this court is not tasked with determining whether an employer's decision was wise, fair, or correct in terminating an employee. This court has said that it does not sit as a super personnel department that second guesses a company's business with the benefit of 20/20 hindsight. At the end of the day, that is what plaintiff wants this court to do. Ms. Prescott's investigation was not a sham. It was thorough, it was long, it was independent. Ms. Aliha just disagrees with it. She disagreed with it then, and she disagrees with it now. But there's no evidence that it was based on any unlawful animus, any racial or national origin, discriminatory motives. Ms. Prescott came in and did her job the best way that she sees fit. Coming in at Monday morning quarterbacking it does not change that animus or that analysis, especially when there is no evidence of animus.
Do you agree that Ms. Dittman did not conduct her own independent evaluation of this before making the determination?
No, I don't agree with that. She resorted to and referenced Ms. Prescott's investigation, but she reviewed it and made an independent determination to act based on it.
Let me make sure I hear you respond.
Sure.
The language we use in our case law quite often is uncritical reliance. So, did she uncritically rely on the report from Ms. Prescott, and if not, explain why?
I don't believe that she had any criticisms of Ms. Prescott's report.
What I meant by uncritical reliance is without actually rigorously evaluating it itself and therefore just accepting it without any sort of scrutiny of it.
No, I don't believe there's any evidence of that. I don't remember exactly what Ms. Dittman's testimony was offhand, but I believe she reviewed it and based on it she's the superintendent, the buck stops with her, so she didn't do the investigation herself, but I'm sure she reviewed it critically and relied on it to make her termination decision, if that answers the court's question. I thought it was interesting that Ms. Aliha's counsel argued that this case was about the facts, but in the recitation of the facts, really, there was more arguments of counsel, more embellishment or exaggerations of what really went on. The word continuous, that she was subjected to continuous comments, continuous derogatory comments, is just simply not supported by the record. Ms. Aliha was asked how often, she was asked to give every instance of discrimination that she faced. She identified them. A lot of them are not purely examples of discrimination. They're faith and neutral. Where did you go to school? What currency does Nigeria have? How do you wash your hair? Things that are not necessarily even offensive. She gave those examples, and then when she was asked, how often did all of these things happen? For each time, it was one time. When they checked, said, but there was other things, but there was continuous, she could never provide testimony. There's just nothing in the record supporting a constant barrage of opprobrious conduct as this court requires.
Why couldn't a jury see the complaints that were made to Ms. Sneddon, some of which you just mentioned? maybe she didn't use the words racial or national origin discrimination, but at least in context, why wouldn't a reasonable inference be that they were at least discriminatory based on national origin, for example?
Because there's no admissible competent evidence suggesting that she ever complained about unlawful discrimination.
But I'm saying if she thought that the comments about her schooling were demeaning, was tied to where she came from, why wouldn't that permit an inference that those were discriminatory comments?
Well, that's kind of a jury question, and I think at the summary judgment phase, what the district court
I'm saying. Why isn't it a jury question?
Well, the district court cited Brown v. O'Perry, I think. I can't remember the case offhand, but it cited this court's precedent that the district court can resolve hostile work environment claims at the summary judgment stage if accepting all the plaintiff's allegations as true and viewing them in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, it still just does not establish, meet the standard of a hostile work environment.
I understand that, but I guess my question is, why wouldn't these complaints at least count on the hostile work environment? May not be enough, as you're arguing, but at least they're on the table, especially when they're put on the table with a complaint about the slave trade.
I think for purposes of summary judgment, they did count. The district court considered them and assumed without deciding that these count as instances of discrimination, but comparing them against the other law of this precedent, including Hernandez, which it's always interesting when both sides think that a case supports their position. I read the allegations in Hernandez, which are much more severe and pervasive than anything that even accepted.
Do you think the slave trade beats were not severe?
Not really, no. I think that Mr. Fox had a jewelry hobby, and Mrs. Weha, who did complain about feeling like she didn't fit in and was excluded, not necessarily about unlawful discrimination, I think Mr. Fox tried to connect with her about something. And this is also why they asked about Nigerian schools and currencies. But that's getting to assuming for the sake of summary judgment that it is that he had discriminatory animus and this is one isolated incident. It's one piece of conduct that is not nearly as severe as what the case law requires.
And under hostile work environment and under the case law, Lowndes being the case that I'm thinking of right now, who cares what he thought? It's the question of what she thought when was presented with these slave beads that, I mean, whether he thought it was a hobby or not doesn't matter. What matters is it one element of creating a hostile work environment for her, right?
Right.
Okay, and what about the question where they asked her whether she ever washed her hair? Now, why is that not offensive?
I think we can assume for the purposes
of summary judgment that it was.
I'm not sure the record is that she was asked if she was ever washed her hair. I think it was how do you wash your hair. But in any event, taking the facts in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, we can assume they were offensive. Though that's two isolated incidents. This is just a handful of isolated incidents. When you go read the cases in which a hostile work environment has been found, when you listen to the oral arguments in front of this court in cases where hostile work environment have been found, usually counsel won't say what was said. They hesitate to repeat it in open court.
Well, counsel, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked your opposing counsel, which is, what are the cases you would point to where there were discriminatory statements made, but this court found that they didn't rise to the level of severe or pervasive? In other words, what's your best case to support the decision here?
I think it's Satunde v. Safeway is the one that comes to mind, which is what the district court cited in its summary judgment order about there being a lack of severity. Brown v. LaPerry is another one. Brown v. LaFerry, rather, where somebody's given the cold shoulder, given silent treatment. In one case, the supervisor said, "Do you know why the inside of black people's hands are white and the bottom of their feet are white?" and making some sort of joke. That was a stray comment, one or two offensive comments that were made. that the court found in the totality do not rise to the level of severe and pervasive treatment. The district court also found that there was no evidence of anything that altered plaintiff's working conditions as far as these allegations of hostile work environment. And I would argue that the district court was correct in making that determination.
Well, let me ask you this, too, because in looking at the litany, and looking at it from the standpoint of the lady that's involved here, at what point, because I'm looking at some 20 maybe plus bases for either discrimination or at what point in time on the basis of these allegations does that not become, you know, pervasive and severe? I mean, there's a lot.
Are you talking about in this record?
Yes, in this case? Record.
Again, the pervasive and severe are two separate things.
Yes.
I'd say we lack both in this case. And pervasive would be if there's just a lot more of it. Again, counsel can say the words constant and continuous, but the evidence in the record is that these things happened once, asked about hair once, asked about currency, cars, once each. And I don't consider those very severe. The most severe thing here is the beats. And probably the second most severe thing is the Nigerian women comment, which is not alleged to have been made about Ms. Awiha, but about another Nigerian coworker. But that's neither here nor there. Those things each happen once. It's also important that what the record shows is that when the beads happen, Ms. Awiha told Mr. Fox that she was offended, and the conduct stopped immediately. Ms. Seddon went and told Mr. Fox to stop it, and he stopped, and we never hear another word about it again. So,
But we're here on summary judgment.
Yes.
And we've got to look at this in the light most favorable to the plaintiff.
Yes.
And now there may be overblown statements here or not, but I'm just wondering, okay, on the basis of what we have, then I'm not quite sure I've ever seen a case based upon discrimination that goes much further than the allegations here.
I think it's the nature of the comments. The hostile work environment cases that we see, there's usually several instances of...
Like what?
Explicit, some things that I don't want to utter in this courtroom, but explicit racially motivated insensitive jokes, racial epithets, racial slurs.
You're saying none of those exist here as outlined?
There's a comment about Nigerian women being bossy, which is not a racial... That's insulting and sounds like racial animus. It's not an epithet or a slur. The beads is just bringing in jewelry to work. I don't think it was intended to be offensive.
But the Nigerian women being bossy, given that she's raising also national origin discrimination claim, that is saying something negative about somebody because they're Nigerian. I mean, that's national origin discrimination, right?
Yes, it's one instance, okay. One isolated incident.
What period of time were these incidents? What period of time did these incidents take place?
I believe the Nigerian women...
No, I'm talking about if you cataloged all of the things that are alleged to have been discriminatory, what period of time are we talking about?
During the entire course of her employment, is my understanding, or that is everything she can remember during the course of her employment, as far as I can remember. I think it's from when Ms. Sen became her supervisor to when she was put on leave, which I think was 18 to 20, but I couldn't remember that.
I've forgotten. How long a period was she there as far as these overlapping?
A year or two prior to Ms. Seddon becoming her supervisor. Initially, when Ms. Awiha started, her supervisor was another Nigerian woman, Lola Longinu. And then when Lola left, Ms. Seddon took over for her. Just quickly, I have about a minute left. It seems like counsel has conceded that neither the governor's letter or the after-the-fact letter from her attorney are protected action. But even if there was protected action, which I'm not conceding, I don't believe her vague, non-specific comments meet that.
Do you agree with their opposing counsel's view that those things could be considered in the hostile work environment context? In other words, the reaction of to the letter was something that is open fodder for considering to be hostile work environment.
If there was competent admissible evidence of that, yes. The statement that Ms. Leo's coworkers were incensed is nowhere in the record. That's not a fact in this case. John Fox, a coworker of Ms. Leo, speculated that he had no problem with the letter. He speculated that we have some people who are, I think he said, are redneck and kind of chumpers, who they probably didn't like it. But he doesn't know. And Ms. Leo didn't depose any of those coworkers. Nobody has testified. I was ticked off about that.
Okay, so, well, and beyond being ticked off about it, Fox speculated as it relates to that, but did he indicate that anybody overtly demonstrated their ire about the letter?
I don't remember. I think it was, I don't remember that in the record. My memory of the testimony is that it was just this, he was just sitting there speculating. And I believe my time is up, but I'm happy to answer any questions anybody else has.
Hearing none. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge.
All right. We'll go for a minute of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to focus directly on the letter. It was reported by her coworkers to her supervisor in HR about her posting the letter as a complaint, saying it was inappropriate. It's obvious that they didn't like it. It's obvious that they were angry about it. Mr. Fox said just as much himself. Why would they have reported her posting a governor's letter to state employees in her personal workspace if they weren't offended, they did not like it?
Is there any testimony that any of their ire about the letter was communicated to her?
I do not believe so, but the temporal proximity of her posting that letter and then right after that, Mr. Fox yelling at her, threatening her, and her being suspended, and all these people bringing up complaints, essentially asking for and hoping for Ms. Aliha to be terminated. And then Ms. Prescott doing everything she can to justify the termination.
How is the reaction to posting the letter discriminatory? What if anyone else had posted the letter and people were upset that some other person posted the letter? What brings this, where is it relevant to your claims?
It's relevant in the temporal proximity to the events that occurred within a week later of the argument, the yelling, and then these people going to her supervisor and complaining about her. It shows the temporal proximity between that, it upsetting them, and them trying to get her fired is why it's relevant. And that is ultimately where the relevance comes in, is that when she posts this letter, when she stands up, I apologize, I'm way over my time.
No, I answer the question.
When she stands up for, when she posts this about discrimination, that she, you know, when she stands up, when she essentially action of standing up against it, the racial and national origin becomes even worse, and it culminates in this argument and fight and termination. That's where the relevance comes in, is that it's this this simmering, continuous thing that intensified, as it did, frankly, across the country at that time, culminating in this posting the letter, and then right afterwards, we find that we have this incident and her suspension and termination. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Case submitted. Thank you for the fine arguments. We are going to now take the break for about 10 minutes, and we'll be back.